The White House's Unruly Neighborhood, Crime, Scandal, and Intrigue in the History of Lafayette Square. Chapter 11, The Biggest Sex Scandal in Washington History. The center of Lafayette Square has an iconic equestrian statue of Andrew Jackson. The general and future president rears a high horse, recalling his smashing victory at the Battle of New Orleans in January 1815 during the War of 1812. The statue was not built, however, right after that triumph. It was sculpted in 1853 as the Civil War loomed. It was meant to symbolize, along with the military skill of Old Hickory, his role as a fierce protector of national unity. Visitors often miss the faint quotation inscribed on the statue's base. It reads, "Our Federal Union, it must be preserved." The statement harkens back to 1830, the year after Jackson entered the White House. It involved a sex scandal, the biggest sex scandal in D.C. history, which is saying a lot. The affair toppled most of Jackson's cabinet and led to a crisis over secession, the desire of some Southerners to leave the United States, until President Jackson took decisive action to preserve the Union. A petticoat affair. The scandal's main character was a femme fatale, Margaret Peggy O'Neill. Born in 1799, she was the lovely and high-spirited daughter of a Georgetown tavern keeper. According to a biographer, Peggy had since her teenage days openly consorted with males in a confined place where alcohol was served and inhibitions were loosened. Recalled Peggy herself, "While I was still in pantalettes and rolling hoops with other girls, I had the attention of men, young and old, enough to turn a girl's head." She lacked inhibitions, and Peggy's appearance was described as a well-rounded, voluptuous figure, peach-pink complexion, large, active, dark eyes, full, sensuous lips, ready to break into an engaging smile. But the young lady had more than good looks. Her parents sent her to a fine school. She could speak French, dance and sew, talk politics, and was an excellent pianist. At age 15 and 16, she attempted to elope with a military officer and, failing that, with another soldier. It's thought her father foiled one late-night departure by hauling her back inside the window of his tavern. At age 17, precocious Peggy seemed to settle down as she married a 39-year-old Navy accountant. This was the hard-drinking John Timberlake. DuPont Circle in D.C. once had a Timberlake's bar named for that tippler. The couple had three children together. Peggy and Timberlake were friends with a widowed senator from Tennessee, John Henry Eaton. Senator Eaton was a bosom friend of fellow Tennessean and former U.S. Senator Andrew Jackson. Both Eaton and Jackson had lodged at the tavern, which Peggy's father owned and where Peggy worked. At that public house, Peggy charmed Jackson with her piano playing and charmed Eaton with her looks. With Timberlake often overseas with the Navy, blue-eyed Peggy and the handsome senator deepened their friendship. They rode about town in a carriage and attended social events together. Rumors swirled that they were intimate. The capital, then as now, placed a premium on appearances. Many among the city's movers and shakers distrusted Peggy's low-born status and viewed her as an amoral social climber. In spring 1828, Timberlake died of a heart attack while serving aboard the USS Constitution. Some said he died of a broken heart from the rumors swirling about his wife. Others pegged his death to suicide and to worry over expenses that Peggy had piled up. Senator Eaton tried and failed to coax Congress into picking up Timberlake's debts. The mourning period for Mr. Timberlake was brief. On New Year's Day, 1829, Peggy, then 29, and Senator Eaton, age 38, were married. Their wedding was just 8 months after Timberlake's death. It also took place 2 months before Jackson's inauguration as president. Andy Jackson's future Treasury Secretary, Maryland's Lewis McLean, joked that Eaton had just married his mistress and the mistress of a dozen others. After taking office, Old Hickory appointed his pal Eaton to the key post of Secretary of War. His choice guaranteed that Peggy O'Neill Timberlake Eaton would stay at the center of Washington City's salacious rumor mills. The president's cabinet was cool to Peggy Eaton, that hussy, as she was called. Colder still were the wives of the cabinet members. During an era when any woman of standing would immediately return a social call from another lady, Peggy was shunned. Department heads and their wives declined to show up for parties that she and Secretary Eaton attended. The cabinet member's spouse who disliked Peggy the most was Floride Calhoun, the wife of Jackson's vice president, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. Jackson began to view the petticoat affair, as the rumors spread about Peggy were called, as a conspiracy among his political rivals, led by Calhoun and by Kentucky's Henry Clay, the former Secretary of State and Speaker of the House. Yet even the president's personal secretary and adopted son, Andrew Jackson Donelson, and his wife Emily Donelson avoided Peggy. In response, the widowed Jackson dismissed Emily, his surrogate first lady, and put another relative in place. The president seemed the most upset over Peggy's female foes. "I would rather have live vermin on my back," he recalled, "than the tongue of one of these Washington women on my reputation." The president's psyche also came into play. Peggy reminded Jackson of his late beloved wife, Rachel Donelson Jackson. Rachel had died of a coronary a few days before Christmas in 1828. During the bitter presidential campaign that year, Jackson's enemies had accused Rachel of bigamy. Her first husband had sought a divorce back in 1790, but it wasn't formally granted until 1795, 2 years after she had married again to Jackson. The campaign attacks had enraged the brittle Tennessean. Jackson grew bitter after Rachel died, convinced the verbal assaults had undermined her health. At his wife's funeral, he stated, "May God forgive her murderers, as I know she forgave them, I never can." He viewed Peggy Eaton as he did his spouse, as a victim of slander. Yet President Jackson took his defense of Peggy Eaton to an extreme. He proclaimed to two clergymen that the twice-married mother of three was as chaste as a virgin. Henry Clay answered sarcastically that age cannot wither, nor can time stale, her infinite virginity. The Jackson administration became a laughingstock. It was difficult to hold a productive cabinet meeting because of the elephant in the room. One newspaper wrote that the interests of the nation were tied to Peggy's apron string. One cabinet officer who liked Peggy was one of the few unattached men among Jackson's advisors. This was the smooth Secretary of State, the widowed Martin Van Buren of New York. Van Buren and the ambassadors of Britain and Russia, who were bachelors, all enjoyed Peggy's company. After a full 2 years of the Eaton malaria, as the press termed it, Van Buren had a brainstorm. The short Secretary of State was a cunning and subtle man, nicknamed the Little Magician. He saw the Eaton crisis as a chance to hurt the career of Calhoun, his rival to succeed Jackson in the White House. He made a startling proposal to save Old Hickory's political hide. The Secretary of State made the following pitch to the president. "As the senior cabinet member, I will submit my resignation. This will allow you to request the resignations of all the other cabinet members, including the vice president. That will give you a clean slate to appoint a new set of advisors, men much more to your liking." In April 1831, this is exactly what happened. Except for the Postmaster General, the whole cabinet was forced out. Jackson sent Secretary of War Eaton and his lightning rod wife Peggy off to the distant Florida Territory. There, Eaton served as governor. Later, the president exiled the couple further by making Eaton the minister to Spain. Jackson appointed a second cabinet much more to his liking. The president would sweep to re-election in 1832, thrashing Henry Clay by a margin of 219 to 49 in the Electoral College. Calhoun tried to get revenge by blocking Van Buren's nomination as minister to Britain, but the New Yorker got the last laugh as he succeeded Calhoun as vice president and succeeded Jackson as president after winning the election of 1836. Van Buren's Peggy ploy came just in time as the Eaton crisis bordered on bloodshed. Secretary Eaton, as he prepared to quit the cabinet, challenged a Calhoun ally, the Treasury Secretary, Samuel Ingram, to a duel. Ingram declined, and Eaton branded him a coward. Then, with several colleagues, Eaton lurked about Ingram's Washington home. The Treasury Secretary hired a bodyguard and fled Washington. Jackson grilled Eaton about this threat to a fellow cabinet member, then let it pass. Civil discord. After resigning, Calhoun and his wife Floride left in a huff for South Carolina. Calhoun's national career and ambitions to be president had vanished. But in the Palmetto State, he became leader of a growing movement for nullification. That's the notion that a state, if it dislikes a federal law, could nullify it, that is, render it void. A sanctuary state, if you will. President Jackson was a slave-owning planter and a state rights southerner, yet he was even more a ferocious backer of the Union. As a teenager during the American Revolution, he'd been literally scarred for life by a British major named Coffin. Officer Coffin slashed Jackson's face with a sword after the teen refused to shine the officer's boots. During the Revolution, one of Jackson's brothers died from heat stroke from fighting the British, and the other brother expired from smallpox, contracted in a British prison. Further, his mother died of cholera while tending to wounded American soldiers. For the rest of his life, Jackson burned with hatred against the British crown or anything else threatening American unity or strength. South Carolina had already threatened nullification and secession in 1830, the year before Vice President Calhoun's resignation. Calhoun was already partial to those views. In April 1830, Jackson and Calhoun attended the annual Jefferson Day dinner of the Democratic Party that Old Hickory founded. Today it's called Jefferson Jackson Day. The banquet was held at the Indian Queen Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue. Many of the attendees gave toasts backing nullification. Jackson sat down quietly steaming. Finally, the president rose, raised his glass, and with Calhoun sitting next to him, forcefully declared, "Our federal union, it must be preserved." Those are the words on the Jackson statue. At the dinner, Calhoun also gave a toast in response to Jackson's. The vice president stated, "The Union, next to our liberty, most dear." Afterwards, Jackson pledged that if South Carolina broke the federal compact, he'd lead an army into its capital of Charleston. "I will hang the first man I can lay my hand on engaged in such treasonable conduct," stated Old Hickory, "upon the very first tree I can reach." Calhoun must have shuddered. Still, at the same time, Jackson engaged in quiet deal-making with South Carolina leaders. An issue of the moment was not slavery, but tariffs, the taxes on foreign goods despised throughout the South. That region of farms and plantations had to import most of its manufactured goods. Tariffs then made up most of the federal revenues, and the South paid more than its share. The second part of Calhoun's toast at the Jefferson Day event reflected this. He said, "May we all remember that liberty can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states and distributing equally the benefit and burden of the Union. In the end, Jackson and Calhoun, with Henry Clay's support, agreed to sharply lower the so-called Tariff of Abominations. Through a combination of threats and give and take, President Jackson avoided the Civil War for a generation, and later got that statue in Lafayette Square. And what became of Peggy Eaton, the woman behind all that infighting? She outlived John Eaton and inherited his wealth. Her two daughters married respectable men. But at age 59, Peggy seemed to justify the view of those who long before had viewed her as a fallen woman. She wed Anthony Buccinani, a 20-something Italian dance and music teacher. He was tutor to Peggy's 17-year-old granddaughter named Emily. But Anthony tired of Peggy and took off with her money and with Emily. Later, Peggy consented to a divorce with Anthony if he married her granddaughter. Thus did the gorgeous hussy who brought down a cabinet and nearly brought on a civil war, late in life, made a respectable man out of a gigolo. The White House's unruly neighborhood, crime, scandal, and intrigue in the history of Lafayette Square. Copyright 2021 by Edward P. Moser and McFarland Publishing. Available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon Books, and booksellers everywhere.